You're listening to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rockland, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hey there, welcome to the Dr. Nina Show on LA Talk Radio. I am your host, Dr. Nina Savelle Rockland, and I am here to help you stop counting calories, carbs, or fat grams, or macros, or anything. Stop dieting so you can easily get to your healthiest weight and get on with your life, because that is my goal. I want you to wake up and think about your day, not your diet. Think about what you want to do that day instead of what you weigh. If you would like to call in and talk with me today, the number is 323-203-0815. That's 323-203-0815. I would love to hear what is on your mind, what is eating at you, because the real problem with binge eating, stress eating, any kind of emotional eating, the real problem is not food. Food is actually the solution to the problem. The real problem is what's underneath, what is eating at you, what is weighing on you. So please give me a call. Don't worry about interrupting me if I'm talking about something else. If I'm talking to somebody, just wait till I'm done with that call and I'd be happy to talk with you. Josh wants to talk about self-criticism, which goes right into my talk today, which is about the ways that we sabotage our emotional health. And one of the ways, of course, is the way we talk to ourselves in a critical way. I just want to finish with the question earlier about depression being a trait for, you know, neurotypical versus neurodiverse people. Depression, and again, I am not an expert in neurodiversity, so I'm this is off the top of my head, but my belief is that it is an issue for people, humans on this planet. And sometimes we are depressed because of our chemistry, and sometimes we are depressed because of, so it's a brain-based situation, and sometimes we're depressed because of situations in our lives, which of course, there's a mind-body connection. So what goes on in our minds affects our brains. What effect goes on in our brains affects our minds. But the good news is that when you can, when you have situational depression or situational anxiety, you can learn to think in a different way, which in turn affects your brain, which affects how you feel. It all circles around. So let me ask you something. And this is to Josh's question, and which you're weirdly psychically aligned, because I really wanted to talk about this. How do you talk to yourself? Do you say mean things that you would never say to anybody else? You would never think of saying to a friend, a partner, someone you actually care about, a child? If you are mean to yourself, if you are critical, guess what? It is affecting how you feel and how you eat. If you're mean to yourself, there is a very high probability that you are going to want to eat just to get away from your own mean voice. Remember, thoughts and beliefs lead to feelings, lead to behavior. So if you're attacking yourself and saying all kinds of mean, critical things, you're going to feel bad, really bad. And if you do not know how to respond to yourself in a kind, critical, comforting, non-critical, comforting, supportive voice, going to use food or whatever to escape, to numb, to comfort yourself. So part of how you change your relationship with food is changing your relationship with yourself. When you are no longer saying mean, horrid, awful, critical things to yourself, you're not going to feel bad. Then you don't need food to cope. And if things happen in life, as they do, that make you feel bad, because unfortunately we can't live in a world where everything's good all the time, which is actually a good thing, because how would we appreciate the good if we didn't sometimes have the bad? But when you have an experience of not feeling good, when you feel bad, when you're depressed, when you're anxious, when you're sad, when you're scared, when you're whatever, if you cultivate a kind way of respond to yourself, you use comfort words instead of comfort food. But you can't simultaneously be mean to yourself and critical to yourself and kind and supportive. So I remember a time before COVID. It seems so long ago. I was at a party, a birthday party. Those were the days. Remember being with people, no masks, being really close, inside together? Crazy. So it was a birthday party, and when it was time for cake, one of the women at the party, I'm going to call her Nancy because I love Nancy Drew. Nancy said, "Ooh, that looks really good, but I shouldn't eat it. I really shouldn't go anywhere near that cake." She said, "You know, summer's almost here, and there is no way I am getting into a bathing suit right now. I've got this disgusting muffin top." She poked her stomach, and she went on to say, "I need to deal with this or my husband's going to leave me for some skinny bitch." It's a lot, she told me. I had actually never met her. So she also said that when she loses weight, she gains it back. And she said, "Well, what if, you know, what if nothing ever changes? What if I'm stuck like this the rest of my life?" She sounded very discouraged. She felt terrible. And then guess what she said? She said, "Screw it." Well, she didn't actually say screw, but I think you can fill in the blanks. "Whatever," she said, "I might as well have some cake." And then she did. And she had two pieces. Not that I was counting, but later she told me that she was disgusted with herself. She said, "I'm disgusted with myself." She said, "I had two pieces of that cake. It wasn't even that good. Ugh, what is my problem? What is the matter with me? Why can't I be normal? Why don't I have any control?" This was my, I think, first and last conversation I ever had with Nancy. But let me ask you, does any of that sound familiar? You ever talk to yourself that way? So Nancy sabotaged herself in five different ways, and I'm going to break it down for you. So the first way that she sabotaged herself is she used the word "should," as when she said, "I shouldn't eat that. I shouldn't have that." I had a college professor who used to say, "Don't should on yourself." I thought he was so clever and amazing. And then I found out that actually he didn't come up with that, but whatever. It's a great way of putting it. Don't should on yourself. So how many times have you told yourself, "I shouldn't do that. I shouldn't eat that. I should be better at this. I should get a better job. I should have a boyfriend, girlfriend, husband, wife, partner by now. I should be further along in my life. I should be happy. I should be happier." So, and often, as I said before, we talk to ourselves in the second person, as if someone else is talking to ourselves. Oh, Barbara is saying, "Yep. She knows people who talk to themselves like that." And Barbara, I'm super glad that you are not talking to yourself, not to that extent, but how about we go for not at all? Often we talk to ourselves in second person as if someone else is talking to us. "You shouldn't have eaten that," we say after we ate that. "You shouldn't have done that," we say after we did that. "You shouldn't want that when we want it. You should do better," etc. When you talk to yourself in the second person, whose voice does that sound like? Is it familiar? Maybe other people talk to yourself, talk to you that way, and you internalized that way of talking to yourself, and now you're talking to yourself that way. So the word "should" causes you to direct anxiety, sadness, anger, recrimination, distress towards yourself. And those feelings can get so powerful because it feels so bad to feel bad that you're likely to cope by eating. So instead of the "I shouldn't have," or "I should," or "you should," or however it is that you're shooting on yourself, ask yourself more like, "Well, what do I want? What am I feeling? What's going on with me right now?" Be interested in your thoughts and emotions rather than self-critical, because here's the thing. I like to say, be curious, not critical. In fact, one of my patients, he calls it the CNC. He's like, "Oh, I was CNC. Curious, not critical. Because when you are critical, as you can see, you just feel bad. You just feel bad with your own words to yourself. But when you are curious and you ask yourself questions, you're more likely to find answers. So instead of, oh, I can't believe I want to eat that cake, or I can't believe I ate that cake, how about, what was going on with me? Why did I eat that cake? What problem did it solve? We know, if you're familiar with the Food Moon formula, and by the way, if you're not familiar with it, if you haven't read my book, The Binge Cure, go to my website, drninainc.com, and get your free copy of the Food Mood Formula. Josh, I'll be right with you. Because one of the things you could do is use the Food Mood Formula to ask yourself, hey, what's going on with me? What is it that I really need? Use the formula to get the answer, even if you don't know why. If it's a big question mark, the formula is going to help you know what is hidden from you. Hey, Josh, welcome to the show.
Hi, Dr. Nina. Thanks for taking my call. I was interested in self-criticism when I saw your Instagram post, because I feel like that's where everything is. You know, that's sort of how we can do damage to ourselves without even really knowing it. I mean, it's pretty much all unconscious. You know, we don't know that we're doing it to ourselves.
It becomes very automatic, and it can feel like perception is reality. So it can feel as it can just feel familiar. And when we get used to criticizing ourselves, when someone else is critical, it doesn't feel critical. It feels familiar and natural. But when you are kind to yourself and you get used to that, and someone else is critical, you're going to say, oh, I don't like that. Mm-mm. No, no. How do we get to be self-critical is also the key. And often it goes back to childhood, when we're not treated well in childhood. And I don't mean like big trauma and abuse, because there are two kinds of trauma, as you know. There's big T trauma, which is a horrible, awful thing that happens. Or there's little T trauma, which is a smaller thing that happens over and over and over. A big stab wound versus 1,000 small cuts. The 1,000 small cuts also hurt. And when we're hurting as children, we don't have the wherewithal to say, wow, you know, I'm not being treated the way I need to be. So it must be something to do with my parents. Maybe they're going through something. No, children say, what's wrong with me that I'm being treated this way? I feel bad. I must be bad. And that begins the effort to change and figure out, well, what's wrong with me? How can I turn myself from bad to good? Because then I'll get the good treatment. That's the illusion. But it becomes a conviction that there's something wrong, and other people are going to see it. And so you become self-critical and you feel like something's wrong with you.
Yeah. That's trauma, right? I mean, that's a great definition of trauma. Or what happened as a result of trauma. We become the abuser.
And, of ourselves, often.
Yeah, and ourselves through eating. I mean, one of the things that I was thinking about when I saw your post was, you said, you know, eating is a way to sort of self-soothe, maybe. Is that what you were saying? But I was going to say that it's also a way of sort of abusing ourselves.
Well,
unconsciously.
Absolutely. I mean, it's different. I should also say it's different for everybody. So it serves different purposes. If you feel, for example, we've talked about in last week, loneliness, food fills the void of loneliness. So it symbolically fills a void. But if you feel guilty, I feel guilty somehow in the world for something, or just a pervasive sense of guilt about, you know, whatever, then food can be a punishment, because guilty people have to suffer. This is all unconscious. I mean, if you're not thinking, oh, I'm so guilty, I'm a bad person, I need to suffer. But that's what's going on underneath. And so, yes, self-criticism also can be a way of identifying with people who criticized us. If your father was critical of you and you become critical of yourself, then it's a way of sort of feeling psychologically close to your father.
Yeah. And my father did secretly eat. He would eat, you know, all of a sudden you'd think he was going to bed and he would be up and he would be by the fridge and he would be, you know, eating just a few bites of something. And I noticed it when I saw it, that this was, it wasn't like a lot of food, but it just made me think he was worried about something and he was using food to cope.
Okay. So that was modeled for you very early on.
Yeah. Like I probably inherited it from him in a sense.
It was modeled for you and we pick up on what's modeled for us. You know, it's like,
that's
not genetic. It's behavioral modeling. And so we pick that up. That's, and then we learn, oh, that dad or mom relate to us that way. That we do. Absolutely.
Yeah. And last week, I was talking about being lonely, but actually the feeling that I have is that same anxiety. It's an anxiety. I feel it in my chest. It's there. And I probably also eat to calm that particular anxiety. Like you said, modeled, you know, just as my dad did it. So if my dad did it, how can it be wrong? You know, now I'm starting to think that it is wrong in a sense, you know.
Well, it's a response to anxiety, but it is not a response that is ultimately helpful. It also, when you are anxious and maybe you eat a lot of carby stuff, that physiologically calms down your body. So in a way, you're self-medicating with food. But when you do it with food, you don't learn how to do it with words. And in fact, that's not just an issue common to your family situation. It's our society, because our society says, don't feel anything. Don't feel anything. Just be happy. And you know, if you're mad, that angry, oh, that's bad. If you're depressed, take a pill. If you're anxious, take a pill. Right? There's just no tolerance for having a human experience. And so how do we learn to even identify or gauge the intensity of feelings or respond to them? And if we don't do that, then everything feels like too much and it's too scary. And food is one way of coping and calming ourselves down and comforting ourselves, but it just isn't an effective coping strategy in the long run. Of course, it's a frenemy. It helps us, but it also hurts us.
Right. And I think as a child, we weren't able to do certain things that we are as an adult. And by that, I mean that we can feel the loneliness that we couldn't feel. I mean, if one of our parents was mean to us, we had to take it, or at least we couldn't imagine being without that parent. And so as adults, it's almost as if we certainly can hack it without the parent being taken care of by the parent, but we emotionally don't know that we're actually quite self-sufficient and emotionally stable and actually quite strong. And the child, though, thinks that, you know, the child in us, in our adult bodies, thinks, we can't live without mom or dad. And so we must behave and we must, you know, go through all of these, you know, suppressing of emotions and suppressing of fear and all of the things that as adults, we wouldn't have any problem with what we felt as a child now, but we don't know that.
Exactly. And I encourage you to say, I as a child, and I didn't realize my strengths, but I do now. Take it from the right. General to the specific for you. And of course, what to do about this? You can't just say, well, it's in the past. You know, it's haunting your present. And so coming to terms with and healing and you know, working through and healing and mourning what happened and didn't happen so that we no longer carry the past into our present and future. I would also, for you, Josh, encourage you when you're anxious to think about the what is versus what if. What if is fear about the future, and it causes us to be anxious and freaked out sometimes in the present. So we have real feelings in the present about a future that hasn't happened and may not happen and probably won't happen. But what is reality and what we know to be true now. And when you stay grounded in what is, it really does alleviate that anxiety. It really does help.
Yeah, so you can probably feel my anxiety. I mean, I tell you, but it's hard for me to really express it other than just sort of this feeling in my chest of a tightness. Just the anxiety feeling that it's very mild, but it is, now that I've been listening to you, I wouldn't ignore it. I would have to think that it's pertinent to the discussion.
Good. Oh, I want to teach you something else about anxiety. All right. Now I don't know if you can see me. I'm going to demonstrate it. So it's progressive muscle relaxation, because the idea is sometimes we need to relax our bodies before we can relax our minds. Sometimes we just need just that little bit of whew, before we can kind of think about what's bothering us, or even think about the what is, what if. Now, if I just say, hey, Josh, relax, what's going to happen? Absolutely nothing.
I'm going to tighten up.
Exactly. Relax. That doesn't help. Just relax. It's about as helpful as saying, like, just forget about it. Just let it go. Yeah. Doesn't work that way. Okay. So what you do is you tighten up, and I'm doing it. I'm tightening. Like, you can't see me. Well, you can see me sort of tighten my arms. You tight, like, get as tight all your muscles, abs, arms, legs, like, just tighten everything up as much as you can. And ideally you hold it for 10 seconds, but we're just going to hold it for 5, 4, 3, tight, 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 tight. 2, 1. Now relax. Relax.
Yeah.
You feel it? You feel it.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, I love the somatic work. Like, I love the somatic therapies. I feel like they're very similar to psychoanalysis, and they go a lot deeper than that. The somatic work is all about releasing trauma and releasing like stored trauma that's physically there. There's a center in Boulder that specializes in, unfortunately I can't think of the name, but it's a very like big deal for people who are into yoga, these somatic therapies. It's almost exactly like psychoanalysis. It talks about releasing a physical charge versus a mental charge, like a cathexis of mental energy. It talks about releasing a physical charge that we've stored. And the theory really basically really quickly is that normal animals don't have anxiety because they're able to physically release the trauma. They're able to shake or sweat. And sometimes we're not able to shake and sweat like an animal does when he's afraid, which clearly animals get afraid a lot more than we do, probably, of dying, you know, in the jungle, you know. But we never release these physical stored up emotions, if that makes any sense.
Well, I think I don't know that emotions are only releasing the physical aspect of emotions. We also have them. We have thoughts and ideas in our minds that we need to change. So if you want to talk about changing our, you know, neural pathways, or, you know, however way you want to talk about it that way, we also have to make the changes in our minds. It's not just about emotions. It's about the way we think and the thinking patterns. So Josh, use this it's called progressive muscle relaxation, because you're supposed to start it like in your legs and then move up to different parts of you. But I find it helpful just to do it all at once and hold it for as long as you can, and then relax. And then, so that relaxes your body. And then you can do some kind of reassurance to yourself.
And maybe exercise. I mean, it makes me think of exercise. I don't know if that's but it makes me think of sort of weightlifting or using weights, because when you do that, you're tensing your muscles, right? I mean,
Yeah. And often people tell me, and by the way, Gabby on Instagram, and I get to your question in 1 second. But a lot of times people will say, oh, well, I was so upset and I ran it off, or I went and punched a bag and go to deal with my feelings. Well, that's a great way to deal with the physiological manifestation of your feelings. But you have to still deal with the thoughts and the meaning that created that physical sense of the feeling, because feelings are physical, but they're also mental. You can't think them away. You've got to feel them, but you also can't just deal with your body to get rid of them. You've got to deal with the thoughts and beliefs and do both. Hopefully that makes sense.
Yeah, that sounds really good. And I'll let you get to that question. Yeah, thank you very much. And I was just going to ask where you think the unconscious sort of fits into all of this, but I think you sort of talked about it a little bit. You know, as far as the anxiety, there's progressive muscle relaxation, but I'm wondering what's going on in my unconscious too.
Well, often it's the unconscious has to do with thoughts, beliefs, ideas, expectations, prohibitions, conflicts that are out of awareness, but they're not out of operation. But not everything is unconscious. And the idea is to take what's unconscious and make it conscious. That's why I say you can't fight an invisible army. You just get beaten up. That's the unconscious army. But when you make it visible, when you make the unconscious conscious, then you can see what you're fighting consciously and go, you know what? No, not today. And so not everything is unconscious, right? But you want to figure out what leads to it.
I mean, we can see the unconscious in our dreams if we analyze our dreams and like our mistakes, like our Freudian slips and stuff like that. You know, if you say like, oh, nice to see you, when you really mean like, oh, I wish I didn't see you or something like that. You know, it's sort of like the unconscious is sort of coming up to the surface in our mistakes. And like, well, we drop something on the ground or something that we made a mistake. It's sometimes those things are unconscious.
Absolutely. Or when people do negation and they say, you know, they say, it's not that I'm jealous, which pretty much means they're jealous. So, Josh, thank you so much for always a very interesting conversation. And I hope you'll call in next week and let us know how you do with these with this anxiety and with your challenging these thoughts. Be kind.
Thank you very much, Nina. And you really helped me out. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Take good care. Bye, Josh. Okay. Gabby says, how can I help my two sons, 10 and 15, with my separation from their narcissistic dad? His behavior for 30 years was emotional abuse, but I didn't know. So often we don't. I'm recovering, but what can I do for my boys? Oh, Gabby, my heart breaks for you. It is so painful and horrible to have a relationship with someone who's narcissistic and they just, you know, obliterate and belittle you. And it's just the worst. So first, I just want to say, I'm so sorry that you endured that. And I'm glad that you are out of that relationship, which, you know, can be so toxic for your sons. This is tricky because on the one hand, you don't want to disparage their dad, because he is their dad. But on the other hand, you don't want to make the behavior acceptable. So all I can suggest is to talk to them, and really use my VARI technique, which I talk about in my book. It's a way of talking to ourselves in a kind way, but it's also a way of talking with others. So validate, acknowledge, and reassure yourself, or validate, acknowledge, and reassure you, the other person, and ask open-ended questions. Ask them how they are, what they're, you know, dealing with, how they're feeling, what are they struggling with, And as if there's a situation, talk about it. And then, you know, you just acknowledge, validate, and reassure them that it's not, the reassurance can be, it's not them, that this is a way that, you know, that their dad kind of organizes himself in the world, and how sad for him and how sad for the boys. But to just continually talk to them, and this is the hard part, without saying what you probably want to say, which is, your dad is such a insert swear word insignias here, emoticons here, but you can do it, because they're going to feel maybe guilty about having feelings about their dad. You don't want to put him down, but you do want to put down his behavior. You do want to address the behavior. So it's not that dad is a bad person, even though you think he is, maybe, but that his behavior is unacceptable, and it doesn't reflect them. That's the most important lesson that they need to learn, that it doesn't reflect them. It has to do with the way their dad operates in the world. I'm not sure that answers the question. If you're still, are you still there? They're reluctant to talk. Yeah. Even if they're reluctant to talk, just talk with them, you know, say, I imagine you might be feeling this. And if they're like, oh, mom, you know, roll their eyes, skulk out of the way. Look, I've got a 13-year-old. I know how that goes. It's like, they don't want to talk. But if you just keep talking, if you just talk, you know, if I were you, I might be feeling this or this. No, mom. Well, you know, I think that if it were me and this happened, I might think this and I might feel that. Even if it feels like you're having a monologue with yourself, believe me, it's getting in there. They are absorbing it, and you're making it safe for them. So just think about, you know, what's going on and how they might be feeling. And if they probably don't want to, you know, they might not want to, if they don't want to talk, they might not want to go to therapy or anything like that. But you can be the safe person for them where they can talk about all of this. So it's going to take time. I mean, they're 10 and 15 and they're boys and it's their dad. So they're going to have a lot of conflict. And you can even say things like, you know, I wonder if a part of you feels guilty for thinking anything negative about your dad or something like that. Just keep talking and keep trying, and but do it in a non-judgmental way, and they will come around. Or just hang out with them. Just spend time with them. Even if it's not about this, you just want to be the safe person in their life. And you'd be surprised. I mean, I take often a walk with my daughter, and we'll start off the walk and I'll say, so what's going on? You know, what's going on? What's the tea? And she'll say, nothing, nothing's going on. Absolutely nothing. I say, oh, what's going on at school? Any boys? She's like, no. Oh God, mom. Oh God. And so we just walk. I don't say anything. I say, oh, look, look at that bird. Oh, look. And then we'll walk in silence and she'll be like, actually, there is this boy, right? So that is one way to do it. And Barbara's idea of engaging in activity is also a good one. Yeah. I mean, just give them time and give them space, and they'll start talking with you in their own way. And I'm so sorry that you're going through this. And I hope that, you know, that you're taking care of yourself as well as taking care of those boys. So let me know how it goes. Okay. So the second way of sabotaging yourself or criticizing yourself is calling yourself names and being mean to yourself. So remember when Nancy called herself disgusting? That was mean. That was mean, folks. It is not nice to call yourself disgusting. Can you imagine saying that to one of your friends? You shouldn't eat that cake, and I can't believe you ate that cake. You are disgusting. You're welcome, Gabby. You would never, ever. Oh, and Gabby, there might be some books. I can't think of anything specifically for teenagers, but there might be some books on Amazon that help you deal with a narcissistic parent or narcissistic spouse, and maybe they would have some ideas of how to deal with your kids other than what I suggested to you. So you would never, you would never say, God, if you ate that cake, my friend, I'm going to be so disgusted and disappointed in you. You would never say that. You wouldn't say that to anyone else, but you might, you probably do say it to yourself. Maybe it's even easy to say it to yourself. So remember this, words are powerful. Words matter. When you're disgusted with yourself, and when you say, oh, I'm disgusting, how do you feel? When you say, as Nancy said, what is wrong with me? What's my problem? What's that like? Is it a nice feeling? No, it is not a warm, cozy, relaxed, nice feeling. It's a terrible feeling. It's an awful feeling. It makes you feel bad, really bad. And not only do you feel bad about yourself. So not only do you have a feeling, you know, lousy, now you have self-esteem issues because you feel bad about you. When you feel bad and because you're making yourself feel bad and food reliably provides distraction or comfort, then you can get stuck in a pattern of being mean to yourself, feeling bad, eating for comfort, which then leads to you being mean to yourself. I can't believe I ate that. And the cycle just continues. So how do you break the cycle? You learn to soothe yourself with words. You learn to speak kindly to yourself. You learn to be a friend to yourself instead of being so nasty. Josh is saying we eat when we want something else. Yes, well, we eat for comfort. We eat for distraction. We eat if you have eaten until your stomach hurts and you can't believe you still are eating even though you are so stuffed that it hurts, well, maybe you're converting emotional pain to physical pain. Maybe instead of, you know, dealing with the emotions that are so painful, now you have the physical pain of being so full. And it is easier to get rid of physical pain than it is to get rid of emotional pain. So it's not just words that are powerful and important, it's also tone. So another way of being mean to yourself is the tone you use about yourself. I remember I used to have a support group on Saturday mornings, and I once asked the members of my support group to say something supportive about themselves one at a time. Just say something good and supportive about themselves. And they did it grudgingly, and they did it like this. This is what they sounded like. I'm fine the way I am. You're going to be fine. This is a painful time, but I guess things will get better. It's okay to feel upset. Right? There is nothing wrong with what they were saying, but there was a lot to be desired in terms of how they were saying it. Not comforting, not soothing, not helpful. This is what soothing sounds like. I'm going to be okay. I am fine the way I am. I am okay the way I am. This is a painful time, but things will get better. It is okay to feel upset. Same words, totally different feeling. See the difference? So when you talk to yourself the way you talk to your friends, because I'm sure that you wouldn't say to a friend, you're going to be okay. You're okay, I think. You wouldn't say that to a friend. You'd say, you are okay. You are going to be fine. You deserve to be okay. You're awesome. You're going to feel better when you talk to yourself the way you talk to your friends. And when you feel better, guess what? You don't need food for comfort, distraction, or anything else. A fourth way of sabotaging yourself, being mean to yourself, is, Josh, what if thinking? What if thinking? Remember how Nancy said, what if nothing ever changes? What if it's always like this? What if I'm stuck this way the rest of my life? That's when she went for the cake, by the way. What if is about fear. It is about the future, and it is about worrying about what could happen in the future. It's worrying that some kind of punishment, rejection, or deprivation lies ahead. Something bad is going to happen. What if I make a mistake and get fired? What if I'm making the wrong choice? What if I say the wrong thing? What if I'm stuck like this the rest of my life? What if thinking makes you upset in all the negative crap? Right. Exactly, Janine. Exactly, exactly. What if thinking makes you upset in the present about something that may never, probably won't take place in the future? So when you have here and now emotions about future events, you are more likely to eat because you feel bad in the now and you got to get rid of that feeling. Food's going to do the trick. And that is why really paying attention to this what if thinking is so crucial. What if is fear. What is reality. Reality is what you actually know to be true. Not what you think, because that can get you into the fear place, but what you know, reality, what you know to be true. When you are staying grounded in reality and what you know to be true, it's a relief, it's reassuring, and it makes you feel better. What if is fear? No. No what ifing. Next time you ask yourself, well, what if this happens? And what if? Remember, what if is reality. What you know right here, right now, today. What you know to be true about yourself and your circumstances and your world. And also, what is how you've handled situations in the past. It's important to remember, hey, what is I can cope with whatever might happen. I've come up with things in the past. I've been challenged and I've met those challenges. Remembering who you are and what you are capable of and your capacity for dealing with challenges, that can also lessen your anxiety. Because when you know you can get past difficult situations, you're a lot less afraid of them. Okay, I have about 7 more minutes. Yes, Josh is saying we might convert them into eating. Yes, when we're anxious, eating is a way of responding to that anxiety. That's why I say food is not the problem. Food is the solution to the problem. The problem is anxiety. The solution is let me eat to calm myself down or distract myself or comfort myself. So absolutely want to get to the root issues. What is the problem that food is resolving? Okay, so a fifth way of being critical to yourself is what I call using the N-word. That N-word that I am talking about is normal. Normal. The definition of normal means conforming to a standard of what's usual, typical, or expected. So to be honest, I have yet to meet a so-called normal person because there is such a wide range of what's typical. And it is also based on where you live, the culture of your family, your neighborhood, your environment. If you've got, for example, full sleeve tattoos, you are not going to be normal in certain suburban neighborhoods, but you might be very normal in a downtown loft where everyone has tattoos and it's weird not to have any. So what's normal? When you say, I'm not normal or that's not normal, you're putting yourself down or you're saying there's something wrong with you. Now, when Nancy said, why can't I be normal? What was she saying? So on the surface, she's saying, she was wondering why she couldn't be like other people who don't worry about cake, who I think, but on another level, what she was saying is, why does cake have such a hold on me? Why am I so focused on cake? So there are a lot of possible answers to these questions. You know, maybe Nancy felt deprived. Maybe she needs more sweetness in her life. Maybe it's easier to focus on the problem with cake than on the problem with other things, like, say, her marriage or something going on with her job or her kids or whatever. The point is, there is a reason she was focused on cake, and she needs to understand that better instead of berating herself about cake. And also, I should say, the anticipation of deprivation or the experience of deprivation only make us want something more. The Janine is saying the Brady Bunch was normal. I haven't found that yet. I used to love the Brady Bunch. Oh my gosh. I so wanted to be in that family. They had the best life ever. They had the perfect mom and dad. They had each other. They resolved problems. Oh, if only life was like TV. Imagine TV from the 70s, right? So the anticipation of deprivation or the experience of deprivation only makes you want something more. So maybe another reason that Nancy wanted cake was because she thought she couldn't have it. And of course, if you think you can't have it, you're going to want it more. And then when you have it and you have that idea of, well, I've ruined everything, that's the all or nothing thinking. Oh, the day is ruined. I had cake. So I might as well have more cake. You know, I had a piece of cake. I might as well have the whole cake. I've blown it. I've ruined it. Alexa is saying maybe the Brady Bunch was written by someone who craved normalcy. Yes, that is such an interesting point. Alexa, stop. Oh my gosh. Sorry. Alexa. Yes, maybe that person who wrote that script or the writers were creating their fantasy ideal that we often, you know, think other people are having, but we don't have. Life is not like sitcoms, alas. Life is not like anything on TV that's a sitcom. Life is messy and complicated and difficult and painful and exhilarating and strange and weird and wonderful and awful and great. Like that. Unfortunately, we watch TV and we think, oh, that's how it's supposed to be. But no, that's a fantasy. Janine, exactly. The more you don't have cake, the more you want it. The anticipation of deprivation. And that includes creating good food, bad food. Right? When you say, oh, cake is a bad food and I'm not allowed to have it, you create this dichotomy of, you know, if I have that bad food, then you feel bad. Haven't you ever heard someone say, or have you said to yourself, oh, I was so bad, I ate cake, or, oh, I'm going to be good today, I'm going to have salad. Oh my gosh, you're not good because you have salad. You're not bad because you have cake. It's simply a food choice. That's all it is. And if we don't think about good food or bad food, then we won't think about good us or bad us. We'll just think about, do I want that cake or do I not want that cake? Pamela, why do I keep saying Janine? I have no idea why I did that. I am so sorry, Pamela. Because Janine has a similar thing. But Pamela, thank you for correcting me. I am very, very sorry. Pamela is the one who has been, every time I said Janine, I meant Pamela. Okay. Thank you, Pamela. Great, great input. So yes, when we tell ourselves we can't have something, we want it more. When, you know what? See, you just, Pamela, you just helped me model that sometimes we make mistakes and you know what? It's okay. We just say, gosh, I made a mistake. I am sorry, I will not be making that particular mistake again, but is it horribly destructive? Do you think less of me because I called you Janine instead of Pamela? I don't think so. And I think it's okay for us all to recognize, you know, sometimes we do our best or we think something and we just, you know, we make a mistake. And the other thing to do is to be kind to ourselves when we make a mistake and say, okay, in the scheme of things, how destructive of a mistake was that? Not so terrible. Apologies. You know, that's it. When you can make a mistake without feeling bad about yourself. I feel bad that I made a mistake. I feel bad that I called Pamela the wrong name. But you know what? I don't feel bad about me. And I don't think Pamela feels bad about me either. Not that I'm a mind reader, but I'm going to take a leap. So you guys, I've given you a lot of food for thought from how to not be critical to yourself and how to not be critical to yourself if you make an error or a mistake. So thank you, Pamela, for helping me model that and discuss it. Thank you, everyone, for joining me today, and I am so glad you're here. I'm here every Wednesday on the Dr. Nina Show on LA Talk Radio and Instagram. You can listen live at LA Talk Radio and Instagram, and you can listen later at the Dr. Nina Show on LA Talk Radio on Apple Podcasts or anywhere you get podcasts. And again, if you want to get your copy of the Food Mood Formula, you can get it free on my website. Just head on over to Dr. Nina Inc., drninainc.com, and download your copy today. Have a great week, and I'll see you next week. Bye for now.
You're listening to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle-Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.